Hi, this is another podcast with SNL Energy. I'm Jennifer Zajac, and with us today is Mark Gabriel. He is the author of Visions for a Sustainable Energy Future. It's published by Fairmont Press. It's currently available. You can get it online. Mark is also Senior Vice President with Halcro, a consulting firm. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining us today. It's a fortuitous time, in a sense. A deal that's been in the works for some time has just been announced, Duke Energy and Progress Energy. Can you talk a little bit about your thoughts on this M&A deal? Is this going to succeed, or do you see any challenges?
Well, look, I believe there's always challenges in any deal, right? Because there's a myriad of parts and pieces and components that really have to work. But in terms of specifics to a Duke and a Progress, they really hit on the key points that I make in the book when I do M&A work with clients, and that is, it's more than just the money. Because I always say to folks, you know, the soft stuff is the hard stuff. Are the cultures correct? Are the management teams able to bring together two obviously fairly diverse companies? And I think just as important, are the physical systems going to link together? Whether it's Duke picking up more nuclear capability, whether it's Progress being able to take advantage of all the great work that Duke is doing on things like carbon sequestration, the Edwardsport plant, and very importantly, will the regulatory environment support bringing those companies together? What we've seen over the past, well, I've been around the business for 20 years, but certainly looking at the last 10 years of M&A, if you look at the five or six that have failed in mergers and the five or six that have succeeded, those that succeed do so because the pieces fit correctly. It's not just about a financial consideration. Financial considerations disappear very quickly. And the overused word of gee, synergy, we're going to have fabulous synergy savings. My experience in the business is that the savings very often really don't appear or don't appear over a short enough window for the regulators to like it. Now, that said, if the management teams can get things in sync, the physical systems are linked together properly, and the best practices from both companies are brought forth, I see no reason why a deal like this shouldn't be wildly successful.
You've focused on management, and that's a big factor when it comes to these M&A deals. What are your thoughts on Jim Rogers being this executive chairman and Johnson being the CEO?
I think both men are tremendous leaders in the business. Clearly, Jim Rogers has his vision of where the world needs to go in decarbonizing utilities over the course of the next 20 to 30 years. And, you know, I can see it working. But I think it's how you slice the pie and who's got the accountability. And really, being perfectly candid, from my perspective, we can talk about the senior-most positions, but it's really the second, third, fourth, and fifth tiers of the organization that makes these things work or not work. It's how do you get through the management levels to make sure that they truly take advantage of the combined entities. That's a lot of the work that I do in M&A, because companies, Duke, which is really a combination of Synergy and Duke and a number of others, and Progress Energy, which is certainly has its roots across Florida and the Carolinas, all have their own histories. So how do you bring those together? How do you have a single strategic vision for those entities? They may decide that, hey, we want to run these as separate operating companies. I tend to doubt it. It really is not just the top two guys. It's the entire, all the teams, the next 20 layers down in the organization. Their signals, their leadership is really what's going to be important.
Let's go back to the state regulators and how important that relationship is. What's your outlook? What's your advice for Duke and Progress as to how to navigate the treacherous state regulator territory?
Well, I never call regulatory territory treacherous. I really don't. They've fought with regulators for over 20 years. The regulators, correctly, in every case, always ask the fundamental question, and that is, what's in it for the ratepayers of, and you can fill in the blank, Ohio, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, right? The utilities can answer that question cleanly, clearly, and without confusion, this will succeed. Because that's, at the end of the day, the fundamental question of the regulators. I've had the privilege of doing work for Duke over the years, and having spoken to some of the North Carolina regulators, the regulatory community has that as their sort of prime objective. And if anything that goes around that, anything where the sort of line of sight to the regulator is blocked, is where I think the challenges happen. I think it's a question, quite frankly, of the companies having their messaging correct, having their analysis done properly, which is, again, saying, let's look at it from the perspective irrespective of the ratepayers of, again, North Carolina, South Carolina, Ohio, wherever they may be. The regulator wants to see high reliability, lowered rates, and in this environment, clearly a recognition of what the issues are around carbon and the environment.
Now, the regulators are looking out for the customers, and you advise in your book that utilities, quote, speak to their customers about the business in ways your mother would understand. Explain that.
Well, one of the things that happens in our business, and by the way, in any business, is that we tend to get steeped in words and calculations that are very industry-centric. And at the end of the day, when you back up, the regulators, as smart as they are, usually have come from a different place in life. They are our mothers and our fathers and our sisters and our brothers. They're not engineers necessarily or accountants, while some are lawyers. They haven't grown up in the business. We get very confused as an industry when we start talking in words and phrases and statements that don't sync with the people listening to it at the other end. And I always told the story, a couple of years ago, I got a packet of information, a huge packet stuffed with magazine articles about smart grid. And it was from Forbes and Fortune and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and you name it. And I always jokingly said it was from my favorite researcher. And the note on the front of the packet said, "Mark, is this what you mean by intelligent infrastructure?" And, of course, I could have taken the industry example of saying, yes, this is exactly it. It's about adaptive inter-islanding. It's about phaser management units, measurement units. It's about advanced and conductoric. And I then realized, I said, well, no, Mom, this is exactly about the smart grid. Again, and I think it's important as we talk about things to focus on communicating clearly, concisely, and with focus. It's why I'm such a big fan, and I work with all my clients around strategic messaging. Make the message clear, clean, and simple. You can always back it up, but if you can't explain it to your mother, you're not going to be able to explain it to a regulator.
Now, also about in your book, you're talking about the importance of investing in technology. Besides explaining it, utilities seem to struggle with deciding when they should invest in technology, how they should invest in technology. Can you talk about the big ones about when it comes in terms of how to invest without regret and embracing technology rather than just sitting on it?
I come from the following orientation, having worked at a utility and being fortunate to work with dozens. I always say there's three things to running a utility. The first one is operating best in class, not necessarily cheapest in class. It is about quality, reliability, security, and availability of our systems. The second thing I talk about is that you have to have great regulatory relations. And last is this bullet that you brought out, which is really investing in technology. When you strip away everything that the utility does around these three issues, they're running big machines. They're running hardware and software to keep the lights on, to keep the gas flowing, or to keep the water moving. So in that light, making investments in technology is the best thing that a utility can do in order to continue to be successful. We're coming off a period of about 30 years of underinvesting in infrastructure in everything in the United States, not just in the utility sector, by the way, right? This is bridges and roads, railroads. In the utility sector, however, our failures are very, very clear. The lights go out, the gas stops flowing, or the water isn't clean. So utilities have to really focus on these issues. How do they do that? Number one, they need to build a technology roadmap, because it's not just putting in bits and pieces willy-nilly. It's making sure that their roadmap and focus aligns with their strategic intent. My old business school professor used to say that strategy is where the rubber meets the sky. And it's wonderful to say, for example, we're going to decarbonize the utility, or we're going to have 50% of our energy from renewables. It's another thing to drive it to the level of detail. I'll give you a specific example. Every day in this country, utilities are replacing transformers. Every single day. But the question is, are they replacing them with the most efficient transformers possible? And I will tell you the answer in many cases is no. They're replacing them with the transformers that happen to be sitting in their warehouses and in their stockyards. It's a question of having the strategy, driving it to a tactical roadmap and plan, and then executing. And by the way, those are things that utilities do fabulously. And how do you know that? Because the lights stay on in this country 99.99% of the time.
But you're hearing as well as I do. How can they plan a technology roadmap when there's so much regulatory uncertainty, particularly when it comes to emissions controls?
That's a great question, and I would suggest that there is more regulatory certainty than we know. To step back and say, to use the what I describe as an excuse that we don't have regulatory certainty, is I believe it's just that. It's an excuse. We know, for example, that controls are going to become more and more stringent. If you look at the PM 2.5 standards or the CARE standards or any of the myriad of changes, we know ultimately there are going to be more and more and more restriction. That's just one of your planning parameters. That's different from what I'm talking about on a roadmap. That roadmap says we're going to be X percent carbon free by some period of time. We're going to allow customer engagement at some period of time. It's sort of like saying, gee, I'm not sure what the fashions are going to look like in 5 years, so I'm not going to buy a coat for this winter. I think it's really important that utilities take that data, and I advise this clients all the time, take what you know, look at the mega trends out there. I mean, we know there's going to be more regulation. We know there's going to be tighter regulation. We know there's going to be more air quality standards placed on us. We know there's going to be a challenge of water. Those are known factors. So to say, gee, well, we don't know exactly what the regulation is, and therefore we're not going to make the investment, I think is false logic. Smart grid's a perfect example. We can look around and say, gee, we're going to wait and not do anything of adding intelligence and communications to our infrastructure until we know for sure we're going to get regulatory approval. To me, that's giving up. That's giving away what you know that you need to do to run the business properly. We know, for example, we're dealing with an aging workforce, fewer employees, greater requirements for renewables on our system. Those are givens, right? Mm-hmm. Those are a no-brainer. So therefore, anything we do to add intelligence and communications to our system is a winner. It's going to help run our systems better. It's going to reduce the amount of man and woman hours out there. It's going to allow us to put more renewables on the system. It's going to allow better flow of communications and information. Those are all winners regardless of regulation. And I look at this, I mean, this is a question asked to me all the time. Now, you have to make an economic choice sometimes. Do I take this coal plant and retire it, or do I take this coal plant and add a scrubber? That's an economic choice you have to make. But that's not necessarily a strategic choice that you're making.
And that's part of business. That's day-to-day operations, in a sense, isn't it?
That's exactly correct. We make these in our daily lives. We do this, right? Your car's running great. You don't worry about it. Suddenly you have problems with your car. You start looking at repair bills, and you start wondering, gee, am I going to pass inspection the next time? You're still concerned about what? Transportation. It's your number one goal is transportation. So I think it's a bit of a boogeyman. Say we are going to be hamstrung in our corporate decision-making, waiting for regulations. One of the calculations that everybody asks us about, we do a lot of that, is, gee, what's the price of carbon? We can't make a decision until we know the price of carbon. And I would contend, first of all, we know the price of carbon. Price of carbon is current cost of your generation fleet in relation to the least expensive renewable resource. That's the math. You know what the price of carbon is, right? So if you're at $45 a megawatt hour for your current fleet of natural gas, and wind is $145, you know the price of carbon is $100 a ton. Sort of an imputed math. But none of those numbers make a difference when you step back and say, okay, strategically, here's where we want to be as an industry or as a company in terms of our fuel mix, in terms of our carbon output, in terms of our water usage, in terms of our levels of reliability.
So to bring it all home and to wrap it up, Mark, would you say that the Duke Progress transaction, does that seem like it's embracing these megatrends that you're talking about?
I think absolutely. Really do. I think that a couple of the companies out there, they are clearly going down that path. Duke has certainly taken a leadership role in smart grid. It's taken a leadership role in carbon capture and sequestration and the IGCC plan. It's taken, obviously, Progress has done its thing. I think they've really fairly well aligned with a lot of the megatrends out there. I think the real test will come again on the soft stuff. I really want to stress that. I think taking advantage, looking out ahead, will they be able to get the soft pieces working? Will the teams work together? Will we be able to align the regulators? But to me, it's a great story. I mean, it's a story that I would be telling if I were sitting at the head of either one of those companies.
We've been speaking with Mark Gabriel. He's the author of Visions for a Sustainable Energy Future. It's published by Fairmount Press. Mark, what's the best way people can buy your book?
Well, you can get it at Amazon.com. fairmontpress@gmail.com, or you can go to a Fairmont Press, or you can obviously send an email to me, GabrielMA@halcro.com, and I'll hook you up with the publisher.
Great. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, Mark. Thank you very much.